And we are live, as was prognosticated by one of the folks in the live stream comments, and we were just a couple minutes late. I'm going to tell you why I'm late today. It's not really an excuse. It's more of a reason, because it's kind of fun. I got one of those emails that says, hey, we have charged you like $600 for some software bullshit that you didn't buy, that you know is a scam. And there's a phone number to call so they can scam you out of your PayPal or your credit card information. And, of course, when you call that number, it's very clear you're talking to, like, a call center in India or Pakistan or something like that. You can hear all of them going crazy in the background. So what I do when I get one of those emails, I call them and I fuck with them. And I keep calling them and calling them and calling them and calling them. And it's kind of fun. It's kind of fun. And that's enjoyable. And I think we should all do this. I asked them questions like, if this is PayPal, how come somebody answered the phone? Why isn't it an automated system and such? And they get really mad. And if you poke fun of them and call them names and point out that they're calling you from a third world data center, then they begin to curse you out in very corrupted English. It's enjoyable. So it has nothing to do with what we're going to talk about today. Except sort of, kind of, it does, because our subject today is don't fight fair, fight to win. And this is kind of like a little combat scenario. And in fact, what we're going to talk about today is not only about the physical world of combat. In fact, we're going to talk about that the least today, because I don't know about you, but I have been in a lot of conflicts in my life. And only a few of them, especially outside of like organized sporting events, have been, how do I put this, physical, right? Like, if you're getting in a physical conflict, like, you know, once a month, even a couple times a year, and you're not like, I used to be a bouncer, so there was some of that there, but even there, it wasn't that often. In fact, I'll tell you a story about how I was able to throw people out with my mind like a Jedi. Today I call it the buddy flip. So even in that scenario, we can avoid it. But people get in conflicts all the time at work, with friends, family members, coworkers, clients, all sorts of situations. We get into what we would call interpersonal conflicts. These seldom, hopefully never, go to blows, but the actual way that we stay in the right state of mind and win in these situations, and you have to define what win means situation by situation, is the same. And it should always be about the avoidance of conflict. So if you saw today's thing and you think, Jazz going to teach us how to fight dirty today, I'm not. It's not about dirty. In fact, I would say that when you don't fight fair, you fight to win, you actually, on an ethical level, move to a higher level. Now, wait a minute, Jack. Are you saying that you shouldn't grab a handful of gravel and throw it in somebody's eyes if they attack you, right? Like, because the ethical standard would say, you know, that's dirty or whatever, but if the guy's trying to kill you, oh, no, it was right in the eyes. Right in the eyes. Dirt nap if it takes it, whatever. When we get into actual conflict like that, sure, and we'll talk about that today, too. And then anything goes. So if you took it to mean that, it does, but it doesn't. What do I mean by that? We'll get into it deep today, but so many people enter conflict following rules that the other side wasn't aware of or never agreed to. And they're not rules. They're constructs of the mind. And we're going to talk a lot today about something some of you guys were exposed to by a very, intense guy, Sonny Pazikas. If you were here at my workshop this year, or you watched the video of Sonny's presentation where he hit our newest expert council member, who wasn't a council member yet, Antonio, with a whip. That guy, intense, Svechnok-trained Sonny Pazikas from the former Soviet Union, who now lives only a few hours to the east of me and southeast of me in Texas. He used two terms in that talk that I actually wrote into my new book. In fact, this entire episode is based on a chapter in my new book. Because, don't fight fair, fight to win is one of my chapters in my new Laws of Life book, the second book in the series. And he used these two terms, sympathetic and parasympathetic, and these are neural terms, and they have nothing to do with sympathy, nothing at all. Not really, anyway. We're going to be talking about all that and more in just a minute. Before we do, first of all, welcome to 2026. Doesn't that sound a little bit strange to hear? And I think you're going to find the older you get, the more strange the new year sounds. Like, I remember like being a kid, like 1985 becoming 1986. There's nothing but when you write the date, because we used to actually write dates instead of type them, it was weird. It took a couple weeks before you like defaulted to the next number. But now, like, if you were born all the way back in the mid-late 1900s, 1972 to be exact, 2026, it only really sounds weird. Like, where, in the words of Tim, what's his name, where the fuck is my jetpack, right? We're supposed to be flying around. He wrote that shit in the early 2000s. So this futuristic world that we're supposed to be living in is only half what they promised, and it's a hell of a lot of worse than they promised, but it's just interesting. And we're also beardless. Well, not beardless. We're back to the normal Jack beard. So Santa Jack is gone. So I hope everybody had a great vacation. I hope everybody had a great time ringing in the new year, enjoyed your Christmas time, all of it. And we are back and on the attack. With that, let's go ahead and recognize our sponsors of the day today. Number one today is JM Bullion. Have you seen what has happened to precious metals? I'm going to say something even though I'm chilling my sponsor here. I don't know that I would go all in on metal right now. When you're at an all-time high this big, I'd be judicious. But I've always been of a single mindset, slowly buy over time, and try to keep about 5% of your net worth in precious metals. I've been saying that since 2008 when I started. This summer it will be 18 years we'll ring the bell on of me giving that same advice before I ever had a sponsor for silver and gold. I gave that advice. I'm still giving that advice today. JM Bullion gives you the best pricing in the industry. They'll even buy your silver back from you. They even tell you how much they'll pay for it when you're buying it at the current time anyway, because that changes with spot price. They accept Bitcoin as well, which is good. And they are just a great sponsor. It's been with us since 2013, and here we sit in 2025. They also ship your orders free, and larger orders, you get a discount if you're an MSB member. Next up today, since we're talking about wealth when we talk about JM Bullion and precious metals in general, if you're concerned with wealth, you definitely want to tune in and listen to John Pugliano with the Wealth Studying Podcast, where you can learn to grow your wealth the way that we teach you to grow your food in a garden. Long-term smart investment design. That's what John does as an investment manager, and he shares what he's doing with his money and his clients' money in a podcast that comes out on average once a week, sometimes more like three times a month, called the Wealth Studying Podcast. And you can learn more of it or more about it at wealthstudying.com. And hi, Patrick. Patrick Rorman's here. Good to see you, bro. I hope your shop construction project is going well. I saw Patrick putting up a few pictures during my time off, but I was pretty absent from all social media and everything. I was mostly working on my new book during the time off while I did a lot of nothing. Okay, I'll be honest with you. But when I was working, especially this last weekend, knowing I'm coming back and cramming into the book, that's what I worked on the most. And the book is, for all intents and purposes, done. All the chapters are written. The introduction's written. I'm waiting on the foreword. If he doesn't, he's a busy guy. We'll see if he gets it done. If you don't have progress for me by mid-month, I'll have to give it to somebody else. But Guy Swan of Bitcoin Audible is writing the foreword for me, even though it's only got a little bit of Bitcoin stuff in it. But it is Laws of Life, too. And I was thinking, what do I come back with at you guys for first show coming out of the gate? And I just looked at the book and said, which one of these have I really not, these 16 laws have I really not done a show on yet? And it was this one. That kind of hit me, like, I want to talk about that today, and I recently did a lot of work on that chapter. So you're getting a sneak preview of Laws of Life 2 today. So let's start off with what this law is really about. And again, this is not about playing dirty. In fact, I would say even in the places where you could say, well, that would be dirty, like, you know, grabbing a handful of gravel and smashing somebody in the face with it, it's not dirty in the situation where it would be used under this concept. That's physical altercation. What we're talking about is anytime there is conflict, anytime there are two sides that disagree and one side decides that we have to escalate the conflict beyond a typical, let's say, negotiation, though All conflict is a form of negotiation. All of it. Even violence is still a form of negotiation. It's basically all other forms of negotiation failed. And now we're negotiating power against power. And we want to avoid that as best we can. That should be our goal. I'm going to remind you guys, if you have any questions or comments for me today, put the word question. This is for people in the live stream, to be clear. Put the word question or comment in all caps before you go ahead and make the comment or the question, something you want me to comment on, and I will try to recognize that you've done it, and I will try to start your comment or question and try to come back to it at the end. All right, so what I mean by this is I want to give you a very famous quote right now, very famous quote, one I've given you guys many times before in the past, from probably the greatest tactician when it comes to battle, conflict, and combat that ever existed, Sun Tzu. This book's well over 1,000 years old, and it's still studied today by officers at West Point, just as one example, okay? And Sun said one time, there is no instance of a nation benefiting from prolonged warfare. In other words, if there is to be conflict, it should be brief, it should be as quick as possible, it should be ended. Because no matter who wins or loses, and those are relative terms, the longer the conflict goes, the worse it is for everybody. So this is about quick, get in, get out, and then be done. And you would think that maybe this only applies to physical conflict, warfare, etc., because that's exactly what he was writing about. But tactics are tactics. So that means if I have a conflict with a coworker, I should not fight fair. I should fight to win quickly and efficiently with all the goals in mind. If this is a coworker and I just dominate this person, the problem is I have to work with them. That's not a good strategy. So that's not winning. See, right there, you can already curtail what don't fight fair means, but fight to win. Winning requires defining winning, at least even if we have to do it quickly on the fly in our head, and asking ourselves what winning looks like, and is conflict worth it in this situation? That's not dirty. Dirty would be, I know something about Dan who attacked me at work verbally, and so I leak that shit and destroy his reputation at work and make him a laughing stock. That's dirty. And it doesn't, and unless I want to get the guy out of the company or something, if that's my goal, and I still shouldn't do it, but if that's my goal, okay, maybe. But in any other scenario, that doesn't allow me to win. That just hurts Dan. And that actually does what? It prolongs the conflict because you don't think he's going to try to hit me back if I take that approach. So swiftly ending a conflict is part of this. But not fighting fair means different things. In a dangerous confrontation, it means exactly what it, not maybe what it sounds like, but what it conjures up in your mind. If two dudes try to accost me while I'm walking to my car, it's on. And everything is on the table. Pulling eyeballs out, breaking fingers, throat punching, ball kicking, you name it. All I wanted to do was get to my car and go home. And two dudes with screwdrivers, you're getting a dirt nap if I'm carrying, which I usually am. Like, there's some 180 grain freaking hard cast Corban lead about to go up your ass. So it, in that situation, it means that. But when we're talking about an interpersonal conflict, we're talking about an argument, we're talking about two people competing for a job, that's a conflict. You and your two best friends at work, all at the same level for the last 5 years, and the leadership team says, we're going to promote somebody to mid-management, and all three of you are in the game. All three of you are going to, and we'll talk about this exact scenario in a bit, but I don't want to make, you know, if it's Patrick, I'm going to beat him, but I don't want to make him my enemy. He's going to end up working for me. And shit, if I'm wrong and I lose and he wins, I'm going to work for him. I don't want an enemy there. So it doesn't mean anything about dirty. It means that we create the concept of fair in our mind. Then we constrain ourselves with that. And we add to it, we're in the wrong state of mind most of the time that we're in conflict. Okay? So to explain that, I want to go into the two terms that Sonny Pazek has dropped on my audience here at the workshop, which was sympathetic and parasympathetic. I think I will say this for him. A lot of you guys told me he was too intense, and one of my buddies even said, I had my hand ready in case I need to draw a gun. That dude looked like I was about a flashback. The Russians are intense in their training, and I think he was trying to give people a little taste of that. If that doesn't appeal to you, don't ever go train with one of them individually because you really won't like it. I have done it, so I think I accept it a little bit more readily. But a lot of the stuff that they do that is, it's not dangerous, but it can be painful, is to work on this one concept alone. And I think that when people talk about it, when these instructors from this Russian mindset talk about it, they like to use big words like sympathetic and parasympathetic. And I think that's fine, but I think you do better explaining it first. Because then you don't have people go, huh? Because like he just kept rolling until somebody said, hey, what do you mean by that? Right? As though everybody knows this. So think of it this way. Sympathetic is react mode. And parasympathetic is response mode. And what I mean is when you are sympathetic in your neural response, it's not sympathetic to the fact that Patrick's knives are really sharp and they'll cut you if you're not careful. This is sympathetic from a neural standpoint. You are in a fight or flight mode, and it's really not even fight or flight. It's fight, flight, or freeze. And often what happens is the first response is a freeze up while the person determines fight or flight. Okay, but it's purely reactionary. At no point does the mind simply accept what's happening and then develop a response rather than a reaction. So parasympathetic is when the first thing that the mind does is say, okay, this is happening. And that could be, again, you're going to have to present against two of your buddies at work for a promotion, or somebody's coming at you hard and you can tell this is going to be violent. Both of those things require the first response to be, this is happening. Only when you do that can you actually direct your response properly. And here's the thing. That sounds like, well, Jack, it's going to take longer. Not when you condition your mind to do it. Not when you condition your mind to do it. Not when you've run scenarios for all the types of things that can go on. This is where we revert to our training to a degree. It's also, though, how when you have these guys that are, you know, professional soldiers, professional badasses, like LAPD SWAT, Navy SEALs, Russian Sveknok, etc. When they go kick doors in and shit and things are blowing up all around them, and they just stay cool and calm and collected, that's a parasympathetic state. They're not in a rage. Now, these movies, guys, you can't be accurate and in a rage at the same time. Would you want a neurosurgeon cutting into your brain who was in a rage while he did it? Probably not. You want a professional who's calm, cool, and collected. This is a very difficult thing for people to rope their mind around, because we live in a world where we've been taught to see all conflict as something to dominate, right? And so either we're in a situation where we immediately feel we have the advantage, so we attack, or we feel that we are completely outgunned, so we have retreat. And somewhere in the middle, we have freeze. So what we want to start doing is just that one thing alone, just trying to move the mind over to, this is happening, and therefore, this is what I must do. And the answer will always be different because everything's situationally dependent. But let's give one more Sun Tzu quote before we move on to some scenarios. And that one is, he who knows the terrain and knows the weather will always be victorious. So you, if you are an attacking or a defending force because you know the attack's coming, you do not choose the place of battle that benefits your enemy. If you assess your enemy and you assess what his strengths and weaknesses are, and then you look at the terrain, you know, unless it's just a straight flat shot from one side to the other, there's probably going to be a point where there's a pinch point, There's a time of day where the sun will be at your back and in your enemy's eyes. Your enemy's using a certain technology that is loaded down and doesn't do well in rain, so you want to attack during a rain event because you're prepared for it, things like that. Okay? That is what he's talking about, the terrain and the timing and the weather during the battle. These can all also be metaphors. When we get into it, like what happens when you have an overbearing parent in this situation and you're trying to set boundaries as a young adult, like, hey, mom, I don't need you doing this anymore. That's the exact wrong thing to say, by the way. If you go into the terrain that is your childhood, you cannot beat your mother or your father. It's impossible. You will lose. You've chosen the wrong terrain of battle. And it is a battle. It doesn't mean it's nasty. It doesn't mean it has to be yelling and shouting. But it is a battle, as in it is a struggle over control for autonomy in that situation. So we have to pick the right timing and weather and terrain. However, sometimes we don't have to make all those choices. We have to build those into the situation as it unveils, sometimes very, very quickly. So let's start off with the scenario that would be what you're thinking of. You know what I said earlier? I just came out of this grocery store. I got my cart and my shit. Dude comes up to me and gets in the way of the cart. Okay, he's already in danger of being smashed with the cart right there. Because why are you doing this? But I'm going to listen to him. And he starts talking. I can tell he's trying to shake me down. Like, hey, man, my car's broke down. I just need a little bit of gas money. He's like, hey, man, I'm sorry. I can't help you. So there's a vibe that I don't believe this guy's story. Right. And I'm also at this point, I'm scanning. Is Bruno here alone? Is Franco over here? And if I get into it with Bruno, is Franco going to come up behind me and chokehold me or stab me in the kidneys with a screwdriver? I really don't know. So at this point, I'm going to keep advancing toward my vehicle and evaluating the situation. If he has one hand in his pocket and another hand goes on me, it's good. I don't know if it might not go kinetic before that, but it's fucking going kinetic at that moment. And exactly what that looks like depends on the situation. What angle am I at? You know, if the angle's right, I don't really think he's got a gun or something. I'm probably breaking his fucking knee, right? I'm going to punch him in the throat. If he's where I can turn him and I can slam his kidney, I know what that does, right? If he's still in front of the cart, that's a weapon. But one way or another, I want to disable this fucker. And I don't want to be Jason Bourne. I don't want to top mount his ass and put him in a submission hold. I don't know what's going on in this situation. So what does winning look like? Winning looks like the parasympathetic response to that. See, the sympathetic response is, I'll beat his ass down. You don't know what you're dealing with. That is a fight or flight mode. The other one is I'll run away. I just run. Turn around, run back. You don't know what's around you. And I'm not saying that might not be the right choice. But is it because you reacted or you responded? But what winning looks like to me is this guy not hurting me and me extracting myself from the situation. So as soon as I disable him, I'm headed in my car. Fuck the groceries. That's not what I'm worried about. I want to get myself into a position of safety and observation at that point because I don't know if they're going to hurt somebody else. I don't know if somebody else is there. I'm armed. I haven't decided to shoot this guy yet, right? Though I would legally in Texas, like once his hand goes on me in that situation, I'm in pretty good shape in a stand your ground state like Texas. I still don't want to shoot somebody. But if all of a sudden he pulls out a gun, well, that calculus changed. But I want off the X first. If because he's enraged now and somebody's mocking him, he goes to attack them, not on my watch, right? That's response mode in that situation, something like that. I won't go into every scenario because there's 1,000 scenarios in that one. But I'm going to tell you this. When I started telling this story, if you thought, well, I know what I would do, and I don't care what you fill the blank in with, no, you don't. And that is sympathetic versus parasympathetic. Because you don't even have the information that you know you're going to get, and you already think you have a response. Is Bruno twice your size? Does he outweigh you by 100 pounds? Is it a little kid? Right? If it's a little kid, I'm more worried about who's around him and making sure he don't have a weapon. But I ain't real worried about him. I'm going to take that if it's a woman. You don't know. And immediately when you immediately jump in, well, I'll do is, and there's so, men are really bad at this. We suck at this. It's very hard for us to stay cool. But when, I'll tell you what, when you're dealing with conflict and the other person's playing real cool, you better think about what you're doing. That person usually knows how to handle themselves, all right? Hunter says, sounds to me like he volunteered for labor. Take him. He needs some help. Needs some help with hard labor on the homestead. So we're gonna take Bruno and put him in chains and put him to work. Let the state do that. Let's talk about a different situation. One that you would think of as being very physical. I'm not a super big guy, but I can handle myself. But I was offered a job and took it when I first got out of the Army and first came to Texas as a bouncer at a club called the Hitchin Post. This was a redneck bar. And when I did that job, and I didn't do it for very long, I did it for extra money and free beer, honestly. But there were situations that would happen where, and the club was a great club to do this for because they always thought about this in advance. They were parasympathetic in the way they set things up. So this club had a policy. If something went on and you got a little mouthy or handsy or whatever, as long as it wasn't totally out of bounds, we said, hey, Bill, okay, you're done for the night. Need you to leave. We can get you a cab. You can walk home. You can get a ride, but we need you to leave. And you left and you came back the next day. Everything's fine. If we had to remove you, you were banned permanently. We even had pictures of people that were banned at the door. It was very well. That made the whole job easier in and of itself. But here's a scenario that happened more than a couple times. Not a lot, but more than a couple. You got a guy, gets kind of gassed up drinking. Something goes on. Again, he's handsy with a girl. He starts mouthing somebody else off or whatever. And then little old me's got to walk up to him and say, hey, man, you're a little riled up. And usually at this point, he'd probably gotten one warning already. So it wasn't an immediate. Now, some things that immediately get you tossed. But look, man, we're going to need you to leave tonight. And that person, especially if he was not a regular, would usually say, well, what are you going to do about it? And I would then inform him that, you know, it's not just me you have to worry about, and I'm going to need you to leave again. If he didn't leave, then maybe we had to put him out the door. But this is what usually, almost never is anybody in a bar like that alone. Usually, you know, there's two or three other guys with him, and they're kind of gassing him up at this point. I'd go talk to them. And if they were not aware of our policy of throwing people out, not letting them back in, I would inform them that it applied to groups that needed to be thrown out together. And Jerry over there is about to get y'all thrown out, and y'all won't be welcome back here anymore. And assuming they like the place, this is what usually happened. The buddies go get Jerry and say, Jerry, we're going to leave now. That's what I mean by it being like a Jedi mind trick. This dude's physically removed from the club, and not a single person that worked there touched him. That is a parasympathetic response. That is looking at what's going around you. What are all the tools that I have, and what does winning look like? Winning does not look like beating the shit out of this guy and throwing him out on his face, having him become enraged, and coming back through the door the next night with a shotgun. Which is something that can and does happen. That's not what winning looks like. Winning looks like this man peacefully leaving and going and fixing whatever's wrong with him that night. He might have just got served with divorce papers and went out and tied one on a little bit too much, and he's angry and pissed off. If you go at that person at that moment with physical violence, you better hope you're in a position to win, and even when you win, you might lose, or some call the pyrrhic victory. I did that job for a while. I physically hit somebody, actually hit somebody once. And to this day, I consider it a failure. I consider it a failure. I never had to hit that person. I shouldn't have hit that person. They tried to hit me and I didn't really hit them. I helped them hit themselves with a wall. But it wasn't necessary. The guy was so drunk. It could have just been, hey man, out you go. Right. But sometimes we, especially 21-year-old Jack Spirico is a little different than 53-year-old Jack Spirico. Here's another conflict. You're in a boardroom. See, now we're going to leave the world of the physical altogether. At least it should not be physical here. In a boardroom, you're having a meeting. You have one of these, I used to call them bloodletting meetings, you know, where like leadership brings in all of the worker bees and everybody says a little piece about their little project or whatever. And you give your presentation or whatever you've been called on to do. And somebody on the other side of the table, let's call him Dan, instead of using Mike or Bill like we do so often, and Steve, let's just say Dan, right? So Dan is one of these smart-ass guys that likes to take little shots at people, point out that your slide didn't have a period or something like that, and he takes some shot at you. Now, if you're in a sympathetic state, then you're going to defend what you did, and you're going to attack Dan. You're going to try to make him look worse than he made you look. We've all met people like this hypothetical Dan. They exist. But what if you just said quietly, you kind of look down at your notes and say, you know, Dan, if there's something that you aren't taking in right now and we need to go over it together, you can talk to me after the meeting about it. And that way, since it's something you and I need to talk about, we won't waste everybody else's time. Now, you've done a couple things here. One, I promise you, if you work for a sophisticated employer with good leadership, they're waiting to see how you respond to that, even though they know he should have kept his mouth shut. This is assuming that what he was doing was a shot for no good reason. Okay, they want to, like, what kind of person is the, who's, they, obviously Dan's not the leader we're looking for, but is Bill or Hunter or what have you, right? And so they just saw that. They'll tell you something else about meetings. If you hate it in a meeting when two people spend more than 30 seconds talking about something that only applies to those two people, just put me in the live chat. I bet you a shitload of me's are coming, okay? No one wants to be sitting in a freaking meeting, especially the guy paying the bill like the head of the table for the salary of all these people, making $50,000 to $200,000 a year per seat, while two people, right? Okay, this is a version of the buddy flip from the bar, guys. Everybody in that room just became your ally. I don't want to waste everybody's time with a two-person conversation, which implies what? Apparently you do. So if you were unclear. Now, let's say Dan was right at what he pointed out. It's the same process. It's a little bit different output. You know what, Dan? You bring up a great point. We should discuss that. I don't think really it's necessary to discuss it right now, though. Why don't you see me after the meeting? We'll tie that up together. See, either way, you've preserved the potential future relationship, unless he's a total asshat. Maybe he was having a bad day, like the guy that got served with divorce papers I'd throw out of the bar. Same kind of shit can happen. Maybe he just got chewed out by his boss, and he's just like, you don't know where that person's head is at that moment, and maybe he's actually normally good at what he does. So in either of those scenarios, in the future, when I have to pull him in on a project, he has more respect for me. If I let the first one, the dirty little hit, pass, he thinks he can walk all over me. And if I write him off when he's correct, and maybe just out of place with where and when, then I'm showing him that I don't value him. Both of those are wrong. So again, the big question is always, what does winning look like here? And if we don't know what winning looks like, how can we achieve victory? Whatever that might be. Let's move on to another one. Same scenario to a bit. We're now in an office scenario. Me, Dark Horse, and 229 Mick here have all worked for the same company for a number of years. We're all about the same place in life in that company. And somebody quits or leaves, and then that causes a cascade of promotions, and there's a new position available as a team leader that right now is the team that the three of us are on. Leadership looks at all three of us and says, you know what? All these people are really good at what they do. All of them seem like they're qualified for the job. Why don't we, you know, instead of promoting from outside, actually do what we say and promote from within, but instead of just picking one, why don't we tell them they're all in the running? And then they can all come to us next week and we'll do a brief, interview on like the next job. They'll give us a presentation and we'll ask them questions. Then we'll all, as a leadership team, we'll step back and say, okay, we're going to give the ball to so-and-so. If you are in a sympathetic state, right, a sympathetic neural state in that situation, this has actually got way more gravity than Dan's little bullshit comment, right? If I get this promotion, it might change my tax bracket. It changes my status. It changes my career arc. Even if I'm like, I'm only going to be here for another five-ish years and I'm going to go somewhere, it's much better for me to leave having had that advancement. You see what I'm saying? Like, this has long-term lasting implications. Additionally, Dark Horse and 229 Mick are going to work for me when this is over with, or I'm going to work for one of them. What does winning look like? Well, in the best case scenario, and it's getting what I want, I get the promotion and I preserve the relationships. What do most people in a sympathetic neural state do, though? They react to the fact that they're competing instead of respond to the situation as it is. And what I mean by that is, let's say that Mick and one of the guys on the leadership team that's going to be conducting this, about once a week or twice a month or so, they go get drinks after work and they're buddies. In a sympathetic neural state, I'm worried about that. In a parasympathetic state, I know who I am. I know what I bring to the table. Just because I don't go drink booze with Tom in the leadership doesn't mean that I'm out of the running or they wouldn't ask me. I'm not worried about that. If you're in a sympathetic neural state and you see Tom or Dark Horse here, let's say Dark Horse and his best friend in the company talking in low toned voices and they stop talking when you walk by, well, they're strategizing against me. If you're in a parasympathetic state, you're like, I don't care. And it's probably not what they're doing anyway. I'm not going to be falsely led. Now, let's go through some different ways that people would handle this presentation. Let's say Mick, he's in a sympathetic neural state. Sorry to do that to you, Mick, but for this, we need somebody to be in it, right? So he's all worried about proving his worth, which he doesn't need to do. He's done been at the company for years. That's why they offered him a chance at the promotion. So what Mick does is he goes in and he basically applies for the job he already has. He talks about all things he's done, how great he is, how he's always come in under budget and on time and all. They already know that shit, dude. You don't need to tell them that. So, but instead of applying for the job he's trying to get, as though he never even worked for the company before, and he's applying for this new job, he's basically reapplying for his old job instead of doing what he's supposed to do because he's worried about making sure he looks good. Right? And then it's like Dark Horse goes into that meeting, and that's not exactly what his problem is. His problem is a little bit different. He's so worried about what I'm doing and Mick are doing and what we might be saying that his whole presentation is about how he's better than both of us. Instead of just look how good I am, I'm better because. So he's now attacking people who's not even a conflict really with. Because in this case, the real conflict is between you and this leadership team. That's who you're trying to win over. You're not trying to beat me. I'm not trying to beat Mick. You're trying to beat the expectation that they have for you. You're trying to come in above it. But since I'm telling the story, I get to be the hero in this story. I come in a parasympathetic state. 95% of my presentation is going to have nothing to do with me directly. I'm going to talk about the team and what their needs are, not what their wants are so much, but their needs. In other words, we've set these expectations. These are the things holding that team back from getting those expectations accomplished. I'm going to talk about the landscape of our product service offering, who our competitors are, and the latest things that they're bringing out and how we need to counter that. And I'm going to talk about how I'm going to make the leadership team look good. And how I'm going to work hard, because if I'm trusted with this opportunity, I want the people that gave it to me to look like they made the right decision. Assuming we're all pretty good at what we do, who's getting that job? Who's getting the promotion? But most people get in so much angst because they don't just accept, okay, this is what acceptance looks like. Okay, I'm competing with Mick and Dark Horse. Okay, great. But what it really looks like is I'm being offered a fantastic promotion. And here's another thing you don't know in that situation. Maybe you're really not ready for the job. Maybe the leadership team knows it. And they're saying, Mick, we know you're not ready. I want to see how you handle yourself. Now, you could still pull off come from behind victory if that's the case. But even if you're not ready, even if they're not going to give you the position, no matter how well you do, why would they do that? Just so they had three? So they could tell their bosses they selected from three? Usually not. Not if they're a good team. They want to see how you're going to handle it. That's grooming you for the next time. That's giving you the experience. So they feel like this guy needs another couple of years behind him. But they know when that next time comes up and you've been through it once, if you handle yourself well and they ask you again, then you're going to kill it. You're going to learn from the experience. So sometimes people feel like when they were offered an opportunity, they find out they really weren't in, you know, like they, you know, it was like, we got Mick and Jack. We got Mick and Jack and we know it's one of them, but we're going to let Dark Horse in the room too. They're trying to see where's this young person headed. And they're also making this determination. And that's not just about the next promotion. Do I mentor him? But if you don't stop and think about what winning looks like, all of it goes away and you just flail around. Right? How about a conflict with an overbearing parent who just doesn't get it? Now, you got to be real careful here. Almost as careful as like a romantic partner. Some ways more, some ways less. You know, if you're in your 20s, you shouldn't be living with your mommy. If you're married, you live with your spouse or something's wrong. So you do with that information as well. But let's say that this is what's going on. You have a career path you've chosen, and it is absolutely not what your mom would have chosen for you. She had this idea that you're going to wear a suit and tie and go in that boardroom with me and Dan and Bill and Mick and Dark Horse. Right. That was her view for you. You're going to be that college boy. It was going to make her proud. And I don't know, maybe you're an artist or your mom's an artist and she doesn't understand how you can be putting a suit and tie on every day, and that's what you're doing, or any version thereof. And she comes over to your place, and she starts in like she frequently does, and she says, you know, honey, this is okay for now, but you really should be thinking more about your future and what's really going to – and you know the song and dance that gets done in this dynamic. Remember I said about the terrain of battle? If you say, you know, mom, you always do this to me. I mean, you don't even want to call her mom any more than you have to in that situation. She powdered your ass. She wiped your ass. You blew her nose while she held a tissue. She picked you up from school when you were crying. She got you off the sidewalk with a skinned knee. If you go into child mode with a parent in a conflict, you have no hope of winning. It is impossible. It's impossible. It's like you're going to fight me in a boxing match, but you tie your hands behind your back and shackle your knees together first. I don't care if you're twice my size. I'm going to kill you in that situation. You have chosen the wrong situation. You have chosen the wrong terrain for the conflict. So it has to be a very mature, very calm, very parasympathetic response of something like, you know, I know that this maybe isn't what you would do for yourself. You know, you have your own life and I respect that. But I actually have a plan and things are going really well. And I'm really happy with where my life is going. And I'm really happy about where I'm headed. And when I get where I'm going with this, I hope you're there with me cheering me on. Now what? What do you got, mom? You know what every parent who's a decent person wants for their kids more than anything else? For them to be happy. They want, if you lead someone where they want to go, it's a hell of a lot easier than driving them there. And it's a hell of a lot easier than leading them someplace they don't want to go. See, you think what they don't want is what you're doing. But what they don't want is you to fail and be unhappy. So if you're leading them to what makes, and I'm not saying this is a guaranteed get out of jail free card with an overbearing parent or a spouse or whatever. Everything requires nuance. But that's where we go to the next part of this. See, most of the conflicts we talked about here are not with people you just met. right? They're with coworkers, they're with friends, they're with family, clients, customers, competitors, right? If it's political, maybe it's like a county commission, but you know Bill, who's your county commissioner or something like that. Those people we know. That means that we're going to have to deal with them again, but it also means we probably dealt with them before. So here's a very unfair reality when it comes to especially parents. You are always training every person in your life how to treat you and how to respond to you. Everything you do, every breath you take that you're in the same room with them, you're teaching them how to treat you. And what's unfair about it as a parent is when you were shitting your pants, you were doing that. You're not responsible for it, but you were still doing it. You know, your brother that shit his pants less trained his parents differently for whatever reason, or toilet trained earlier, or cried less, or cried more. So if you're training your parents how to deal with you when you're 4 or 3 or 2 and still sticking boogers in your mouth, you're definitely training your coworkers, your friends, your competitor, your customers, every person you ever interact with, you're training them how to respond to you. And once you see it that way, you're going to realize something about things like these very close relationships that have always gone the wrong way in the past. You can't instantly fix this, and you can't explain it to them the way that I explained it to you. You can say something similar to that overbearing parent, dad, mom, what have you, or you know, grandparent or uncle, like you're wasting your life, Johnny, or whatever. You can come up with a way to deliver that message very calmly, very clearly, and without reverting to the point where you are the youngster, right? Because they're always, your parents are always going to have powdered butt syndrome is what David Ramsey calls it. I powdered your ass. I'm not taking your advice about money or life or anything else. That's fine. They don't have to take your advice, but you don't have to take their advice any either. See, a lot of times these assertions made by well-meaning family members are out of their fear. That's their fear, not yours. Don't let them transfer it to you. And in training them how to respond to you, you might have to go through that process with them 3 or 4 or 5 times. But if you're 25 years old, you've been training your parent how to treat you for 25 years. If you can get out of it in 5 conversations and move into a new dynamic, that's pretty damn good. That's pretty miraculous. You have to be patient. If you brought a 2-year-old stray dog in off the street and it was nice dog, like it didn't bite or anything, maybe a little flighty, but it had no discipline. It didn't know how to sit or stay or walk on a leash or go inside or wait, right? It didn't know how to do any of that shit. And you said, sit. The dog didn't sit, you'd say, this doesn't work. You'd be patient. You train a dog to sit. It might take a few days before you get sit down. Once we get sit down, we can work on lay, and we can work on leave it, and we can work on wait, right? Like, you would be patient, and you would understand that this training takes time. Your mom's a lot more complex than a golden retriever you picked up on the side of the road. It will take time, but it will work. And it's, I don't care how long it takes to work. It's a better alternative than, oh, mom, you always, the minute you say you always say this, it's over for you, right? That's for your spouses too. And the closer you are to the person, the more you better ask yourself before you engage in conflict at all, what does winning look like? Because sometimes when we ask that question, what does winning look like? It's so we can architect the win. Sometimes it's so we can go, if I engage in conflict in this situation, the best case scenario is bad. So what do we do in that situation? Remember the old movie War Games with tic-tac-toe? It's a strange game. Why don't we play chess instead? We don't fight. We don't have that conflict. We stay out of that conflict because winning is not good. The only way we go into a conflict where winning is still not good is where not having a conflict is not an option. That's back to Bruno in the parking lot. Once he puts his hands on me, we're having a conflict. The conflict is now. It's already begun. So I would prefer to just get in my car and leave that retard in the middle of the road, stand there looking at his own feet. But once I prevent, now I have to. But in every scenario, and again, the closer we are, I have to work for you, you have to work for me, you're my family member, you're my parent, you're my spouse. If winning looks bad, don't do it. See, fighting fair is this person tried to bait you into a conflict. Fair would be you respond to it the way they want you to, with aggression of your own. Sometimes that's the wrong answer. I'm on a kick with this one. It's in my book a lot. It will be a lot more in my next book, which will not be Laws of Life, by the way. But if you get my second book, you'll probably be able to figure out what the third book is. A little teaser there. You should also ask yourself not just what winning is, but what is the desired outcome? In the best case scenario, not necessarily what is winning look like, in the best case scenario, if I can wave a wand and get this output, what is that output? If it's a parent, right, overbearing parent like I was just talking about, then the best case scenario is they say, Billy, you know I want the best for you, and if this is what you want to do, then you've got my blessing. Tell me how I can help, including if I get out of the way. Best case scenario. Doesn't mean you're going to get there, but wouldn't it be nice to know what it is? You and your wife are arguing about whatever it is. I only want to go there because I might pick something you just argued about your wife with. And if I phrase it wrong, you can go to your wife. Jack Spirico said I'm right, and I will throw your fucking ass. If anybody's spouse ever comes to me with that kind of shit, I will throw you under the bus. I will get in the bus. I will back the bus over you, drive the bus over you, back the bus over you again, and then get you under the back wheels and do a donut with you with the bus under the bus. Okay? So I don't want to do it. So whatever your argument, what does the best case scenario look like? You're trying to convince her or him, depending on which spouse you are, to do a thing. Yeah. Best case scenario, she says, do whatever you want in that tone of voice. And you go, okay, like, bro, don't do it. Don't do it. But you get what I'm saying. Like, you can win that battle and lose the war that is the lifelong project you've embarked on together as spouses, right? Like, you're supposed to, till death do you part. Or you can damage your future. What does winning look like? Both the best positive outcome, and if this conflict is going to create a negative outcome no matter what, can we avoid it? Can we shift it to a different discussion that gets us both what we want? I have people all the time, I want to move. My wife doesn't want to move. But you think you guys should talk about it, but not from a standpoint of why you should move, because that's what people will come to me for. That's why I won't do it. I know it's bad for you. You should talk about what both of you want in where you live. And that conversation, because you might have already burned some of that bridge, might start out with what you want is to leave. I didn't ask you what I wanted. I asked you what you wanted. And then what's going to happen next? Well, I want to live right here. Okay, why? Because this is where we live. No, I don't mean that. I mean, what do you love about where we live right now? When you do that, you might find out that the things she loves are things you kind of like too. And maybe there's a way for both of you to get what you want. That would be winning in a relationship like that. Staying and hating it, or moving and having her resent you for it, or him resent you for it, doesn't win either. You don't win either that way. You always have to be asking, when you have those type of interpersonal dynamics going on, how do we both win? And that's the best way to negotiate too, even with like a client or a supplier. If you're bidding a job and trying to get the job, you're negotiating terms, you always want to try to lay out a scenario where both sides feel I got a good result. I got what I wanted. I got the most important things to me in that situation. And you have to approach every conflict with 5 primary objectives if you're going to be able to do this and stay in that parasympathetic state. Always approach all conflict with the first desire being de-escalation. Can I lower the temperature? Can I reduce the tension? If this person's defensive, can I draw them in where they feel less need to be defensive? If this person's being offensive, can I back them up subtly just enough that they settle down and I can have a discussion about de-escalation? But one way or another, I should always be thinking if there's conflict brewing, whether it's an argument, a contentious decision inside a business, two people in a bar or a parking lot, the temperature is here. But if it's heading toward conflict, that means that temperature is rising. And I want to chill it as quickly as possible. So that's objective one. The next thing is you have to stay in control of your emotions. Your emotions really shouldn't play any part. And part of that parasympathetic state is, since this is happening, how I feel about it doesn't matter. My emotions don't matter. They don't mean anything. Facts don't have feelings. All right. It feels good when you're the one saying it. It's a different thing when you have to take it in. So by staying in control of your emotions, you're able to continue to respond versus react. When a person is, oh, don't say that. No, not to a woman, bro. Hunter just said, so just calm down. Yeah, it helped you. That's advice old assholes like us give to young bucks with her. We just tell her to calm down. She'll calm right. No, right. You gotta be careful how you phrase things. But you do want to, that's the message, just not the verbiage, depending on who you're talking to, you know? And that doesn't really work well with anybody. Hey, you need to calm down, buddy. Like it may be worse for you to say that to a woman that's upset about something, but it doesn't work on a dude either, especially in something like, let's say it has potential to go physical. If I say you need to calm down, what is the first response you have? Me? I'm not the see, right? What's going on? Is a bouncer? That was my number one line. If it was two people and that was what's going on? Well, hold on. It's okay. I'll listen to both of you. I feel like a lefty today, so I'm going to go with you because you're on my left. I'm not like favoring you, but just you tell me what you feel is going on. And you tell me what you feel is going on next. All right. So let him talk and I'll listen to you next. Okay. Yeah. All right. Boom, boom. And then right there, the temperature drops because both of them got it out. They were so busy screaming at each other. They didn't feel what the other one was feeling. It doesn't always work, but usually that'll bring it down. And in an office environment, that was my main tool, and I learned it as a bouncer. I have two employees that were starting to go at each other. Sit them down. What's going on? You need to calm down, Grimes, who is one of these employees I'm thinking of, would not have worked on that man at all. It would have made everything worse, and I would have had to fire him before I did. I wouldn't have got another good year of work out of him, right? He got fired for performance, not for those issues, but he had those issues. It probably impacted his performance. But tell me what's going on. Okay, now you tell me. Not is he, it's what he's saying true. Because now I'm now mediating a conflict instead of mediating a resolution. This works even when you're one of the, well, I'm sorry that you're upset. Why do you feel that way? What do you feel that I've done? That's hard to be aggressive toward. Unless you did something really bad, you know, like, you stole your best friend's girlfriend or something. You're on your own. You did that shit. You aggressed first then, right? You didn't follow the non-aggression principle if you did that. So stay in control of emotions and then seek to do minimal harm in conflict. Whatever that means for the relativity of the conflict. Again, that dude in the parking lot I was talking about, let's say he's dressed in like a wife beater and shorts. And I can see he does not. I know he doesn't have a weapon on him. I'm probably not shooting him. I mean, I don't know. He could be Bruce Lee or some shit. But if he's the kind of guy that does that, he probably isn't. He's probably getting a kick to the knee or the nuts or something if it goes that far. Because that's all the damage I need to do to buy myself the time to leave. If he's got a screwdriver in his hand, he's probably getting a dirt nap. You know, if he's being aggressive with it, hey, man, look, I told you. Sorry. So minimal harm is relative, but again, most of what we talked about today isn't physical. And minimal harm is so important because let's say that I'm in competition with a competing company in a bidding situation, but the bids are really close and we're now in kind of this final selection criteria and I MF the hell out of my competitor and it works. You know, companies have to work together at times. You can end up on the same job doing different parts of it. Somebody someday might ask him what they think of Jack Spirko, CEO of this other company. He might say he's a prick. And that might be somebody I need to have a good relationship. That's not good just because I won that one individual. And actually, I'm probably going to lose. If that other guy comes in and stays in that parasympathetic state, there's nothing wrong with Jack's firm. But tell me what it is that he's offered you that still has him in the running and you haven't chosen me yet. That customer will tell you everything you need to know to beat me if you're in that state. I've been there. They'll tell me everything I need to know. You know? And I'm actually, and if I'm not doing it already, I'm doing it in the future, not just for them. In fact, I actually ended up with a competitor learning about me, and even though I won that individual bid, they started doing what I did in my cabling bids. I gave my prospective client who the lead tech would be, who the project manager would be, and myself all in there listed how we could be contacted, email and phone number, and hours of availability, and conferred to them that meant that 24/7 one of us could be reached when we were in the middle of their $500,000 project at all times. The person who would do the job had already been chosen. That was the main reason we beat my competitor, but my competitor was smart enough that when I was bidding against them in the future, they were using that tactic because my customer told them what it was. I don't think I told them everything, but they told them that one. Now, if you're going in and attacking the other side in that situation, none of that happens. You've lost the opportunity to learn. You've burnt a bridge before you even saw that it was there. So minimal harm. Then remember to use even more restraint with people you love. When you're in a conflict with a spouse, brother, sister, cousin, your father's cousin, sworn roommate, anything like that, and you feel that temperature rising, don't just try to bring the temperature down for it. Bring your own. You can't really control the other side's temperature. You can control your own. You can do it. I've seen people do it. It's actually possible for you to go, this is making me really mad right now, but I understand where it's coming from, and they don't really mean it, or they mean it right now, but they won't mean it tomorrow. And if I engage with this right now, it's going to get heated and it's going to be worse. And so I'm just not going to. It's hard sometimes, but you have to use incredible restraint with people that you care about. The more you're going to see them in your future, the more restraint you need to use. That way, when there is actual conflict, it's precise. It's accurate, it's controlled, and it's sufficient, but it's never excessive. And then here's that hint at the next book in the series. You should always check your North Star goal when making such decisions. What's a North Star goal? This is your overriding place you're trying to get to in your life arc. This is who you want to be when you grow up. It's what you want your family life to be like. It's what you want your professional life to be like. It's your retirement goals. It's a total picture of future you as you envision future you in your best life. It's amazing what happens, and it's important to develop that vision. But once you have it, it's really easy because, again, most conflicts aren't a dude with a screwdriver in a parking lot. I've used that analogy a hell of a lot more than I've ever experienced it because it's never happened. I've had the guy pretending he needed $5 to get home or whatever, but I've never had a point where I need to hit somebody or shoot somebody in that situation, right? But I've had plenty of situations where, like, not only is there a conflict, but I already knew it was going to happen before I stepped in the room. I mean, I had time. And when you look at that, you say something to yourself like, wait a minute. Here's where I'm trying to get in my life. This is me 30 years from now. Is this neutral, positive, or negative? When I ask the question, what does winning look like? And if it's negative to getting to where I want to be, then I can't win. If winning is negative to my ultimate goal for who I am in my life, and I engage in conflict, I can't win because either I win and lose, or I lose and really lose. Do you see how simple it makes things so simple? Like, again, there is those acute situations, but most situations that we end up in these conflicts are chronic. I mean, they're continuously recurring. You have time in that situation to train that person through the new you how to treat you. And one way to do that is a defining of boundaries and individual sovereignty to, you will not pull me into this. Do you like fighting? Again, I'm not talking about going into a ring and doing jiu-jitsu or some shit, right? I'm saying, do you like to argue with your mom? Is that what you think? Gee, I can't wait to get in an argument. Then you don't want to do it. So if you are baited into it, you already lost. If you don't want to have a fight with your girlfriend, don't. If it's just your girlfriend and she insists on a fight over and over again when you can, and she doesn't learn from your new persona, then you need a new girlfriend. If you married somebody, you owe it to them to work through a little. There was a reason you made that commitment. Now, if you got married in 3 days in Vegas or something, you do what you want with that. But you get what I'm saying. Check that North Star goal when you're making those decisions. Now, I actually, one of the things about the new book, and I'm going to be doing a second edition of the first book, correcting some of the errors that are still there, but adding some things that I found in this journey, right? The second one was going to be these formulas at the end of every chapter that help you run a filtering formula to apply the law to your life. But it's also to help you revisit it, and then you can take these formulas and make them whatever you need them to be for you. But since this is about conflict, how about the way of the fist, actually the fist formula, even though we're not talking about hitting people. So here's how the fist formula, every letter, it's an acronym, it starts a word. So F is frame the fight. Frame the fight. This is choosing your terrain and the weather. This is defining what's actually going on. This is the first step in acceptance. This is happening. And again, in actual conflict, I keep reiterating this, but it's very important because people always get hung up on it. If you can get into this, your response time is actually faster. You can respond quicker than you can react when because the response is accurate. It's precise. But frame the fight. What's going on? I'm in it for a promotion. This is an overbearing parent. What exactly? And what this has happened before? And what were the results of the way I acted before? And were those good? If they were bad, then I probably shouldn't do the same thing. So frame the fight. Then, because we frame the fight, we have the opportunity to use the eye and fist, right? Interrupt the pattern. Most people, your entire pattern, your entire life has been being in a sympathetic nervous state because no one ever told you there was another option. Right? I mean, there are those people that are just naturally chill. They just exist in that state, right? Just not most people. Most people even that seem like that, then when the actual conflict comes, they lose it, you know? So when you become parasympathetic, you change the script in training others how to treat you. So that's interrupting the pattern. That's not doing the same thing that you've always done that's gotten you shitty results. Definition of insanity, misattributed to Einstein. Then strike. Only when and as hard as necessary. So if there is going to be conflict and I do have to strike, what does that strike look like? Is it a hard strike? Is it a soft strike? Is it a gentle move? Is it, in the words of Mr. Miyagi, best block, no be there? Or is it a counterpunch? Every situation is different. But what we should always be doing, and this is back to these crazy Russians, you go to these training and they hit you the whip or punches you 10 times or puts you in a plank for 2 minutes until you feel like your body's going, but this is where I first heard drilled into me over and over when I was working with Valerie Osanoff. Sufficient force. Always the force must be sufficient in that it must give me the advantage in the conflict so that I no longer risk not going home to my family. But it should be only sufficient. It should never be overkill. And he was talking about full-on kinetic fighting. That is so much more true when it's a coworker, a family member, a spouse, a friend. So much more true. You know, the way of the fist, Cobra Kai, right? Strike hard. Strike first, strike hard. No mercy. No. Strike when necessary and only when necessary and only as hard as necessary. And that is with your words, your actions, your deeds, what you say to a person, what you say about them. All those things are in this. And then T. The T in fist is take the win. This is ending the conflict cleanly and returning to your focus, going back to your actual goals in life. No, I beat him. I told him. No conversation. You don't need to have a conversation. You go into a conflict with somebody. Now, I get if you come home and you decompress to that spouse or your best friend that's not connected to your office. But if I defeat somebody in some sort of conflict in an office, for instance, some argument, somebody trying to assert authority over me that they didn't have. So I basically explain to them how I don't work for them. They don't sign my paycheck. And if they would like my help, they can ask for it. I don't need to walk over to the next office and tell my friend, Dan just came in here. Yeah, I fucked his shit up. I sent his ass back. And then usually when somebody does that, no matter how well they handled it, they exaggerate the win, right? I knocked his ass out type of mindset, even if not the exact words. That doesn't help. Now the conflict is over and you're continuing it for no reason other than a victory lap. When you are done with conflict, remember what I said, you're always training people? If I have that interaction with Dan, he's probably looking for me to do that. He's probably got his ears up. He's now hurt. Even if I only struck sufficiently, he's probably now a little bit emotionally injured. He may go to his boss and say, well, Jack, and his boss may say, Jack's right. He doesn't work for you. I mean, I'm not going to tell him I don't work for him if I do. Like, if you want his help, you're going to have to ask for his help. Like, so he's waiting for that victory lap thing to happen. And when it doesn't, and that might actually, if there's a chronic problem, that might have to actually happen a couple times where you're like, oh, wait a minute. Once he's done, he's done. Like, real, for real done. He's not going to MF me. Even though I did it to him, he's not doing it back to me. He just goes on about his shit. What does that do? That further disarms that person. It also makes them a future potential ally. That's what happens when you take the, what take the win means. It's not woohoo. It means shut up. It means shut up. And it, you know where this goes really wrong? Marital relationships. I want this. No, I want this. No, I want this. Fine. I don't want to do it now. You know which way that one's usually going. But men, you do it too. You just sound different when you do it. You said you wanted a thing. The other side conceded. The right response to that is thank you. And I know there's some women listening to that. You're upset right now because I used the vernacular that put it obvious where it was going. Like I said, I'm saying it goes both sides. But I am going to tell you this. There is no way you were still making your point 30 seconds ago and didn't want to win. Because if you had decided, fuck it, it's not worth it, you would have still been making a case. And that goes to both sides. It could be two dudes having this argument. It's just less common. But when the other side says, okay, especially they say, all right, not whatever, but all right, you clearly wanted that outcome. And now what are you doing? You're extending the conflict by saying, now I don't want it. And again, dudes do it. We just sound different when we do it. Humans are humans. We do the same shit. We just have different ways we communicate, Mars, Venus, that type of thing. So take the win and move. You're trying to get somewhere in your life. You're trying to get somewhere in your relationships. You're not trying to get somewhere in your career. Every minute you spend engaging in post-conflict celebration is only extending conflict, and that means you're wasting the fucking time that God gave you, to be blunt. Remember always, there is one commodity and only one commodity in the world that you can never get back. Anything else, no matter how high you go and how far you fall, if you're alive, it can be reacquired. You can be worth $1 million one day, zero the next, And most people that happens to, if it was real wealth, not some bullshit, fake stock options or something, give a couple of years, they'll be a millionaire again. They'll do it five times as fast as they did it the first time. You can make money back. If you lose gold, you can get your gold back. If you lose your Bitcoin private keys, you're stupid. You shouldn't have done that. But you can buy more Bitcoin. Maybe you'll never get back all you had, but you can replace some of it. You can't replace a second of time once spent. It is the most precious commodity slash currency in the world. And when you're taking a victory lap and hence prolonging a conflict, you are pissing away your time. Interesting, isn't it? I don't know. A lot of times when I do shows like this, I just think to myself, these are not concepts a 10th or 11th grader is incapable of understanding. How the fuck do we put kids in a chair in a school for almost 20,000 hours over 13 years, and we don't teach them basic life things like this? If a redneck hippie duck farmer can come up with it over the Christmas vacation. Maybe because they don't want you to know these things. You think I'm the only one that knows these things? You don't think there's 100 books you can read that say some version of the same thing? You don't think this isn't exactly like this concept of your emotions don't matter, what is what matters? Framing things, being in a parasympathetic state. You know what that sounds a lot like? Because it is. It's called stoicism. This is Marcus Aurelius. This is that's what this is. This is the Roman Stoics modernized into our world. This isn't new. They don't teach you this. You know why? How hard is class warfare with people acting this way? No class warfare. Boy, that's kind of bad for. Just ask yourself, who's that bad for? If class warfare were done away with, if you say, well, so-and-so over there has that, and you go, yeah, that's okay. That's so-and-so. He has the thing. He earned the thing. It's his thing. The fact that he has that thing isn't why I don't have the thing that I want. You are. So why don't you explain it to me from a standpoint of what you've done and what you're going to do to change that instead of the fact that this person over who is harmed by this? Are you? Is your buddy across the street who you sort of get along with, but you have political differences with? Is your brother who's done way better or way worse than you in life from a career standpoint? Do either of y'all, you know, get hurt by people understanding this? No. So when you want to know why we don't teach people this, well, there's a reason. It's very easy to get a reaction from a person in an emotional, sympathetic, neural state. I think we're long past being banned for this, so I'll point it out. What did they do to you during the COVIDs? Real time. Yeah, do you ever notice how they memory hold the real time death counter? But remember in the beginning, they just had this number at the bottom of every news cycle. The number of people, like they can't possibly know that. So even after people stopped being hyped up by it, and it stopped working, they just quietly got rid of it. And if you ask, oh, that never happened. Here's video of it happening. Still hard to find. It's not a Mandela effect. We really saw that. They really did that shit. No one is immune. It can be very serious even for the – like they did everything they could. 800 people died today in Italy. You can't go there or see that. You have to take their word for it. And you should have asked yourself, how many people die in Italy on a daily basis anyway? The morgues are overloaded. I don't know. I went and looked, and there was nothing there. But they put the world into a highly sympathetic neural state. Why? Because that's how you get what you want. When you are aware of the strings you're pulling, and the people you're pulling the string on aren't, you need them in that state. So if you think this is only just a topic about how to improve yourself, and it is. It's also a lot more. It's about how society is controlled. And what that means is even more to the point, when the hardest part of this philosophy is when Dan pisses you off saying, but Dan wins if I don't thump his ass. No, you lose when you do, because now you're being controlled. And since Dan pulled the strings, who's controlling you? That's why you're called pulled in. And that's why part of being a Stoic is not being pulled in. That's nice strings you got there. Too bad they broke. How can I help you? What do you feel is going on? What do you feel is wrong? What do we need to do to get past this? It's a totally different approach. And then, like I said, then when they tell you, but so-and-so, these people over there, they have all the money. The boomers stole it. That's nice. That's nice. Good story, bro. Good story. Let's get back to the part where you're actually the one in power. All right? And then you realize that person's not going to do anything for you anyway, so your real conflict is with yourself and getting what you want in spite of them. But that's a different chapter in the book. But I promise you, that one's there too. Remember, all conflict is negotiation. That's a very important component to this. Even violence is a form of negotiation. We're just negotiating at a different level once we go to violence. That's why we want to avoid it. Anyway, there was not a lot of questions, at least that I saw. A lot of activity in the chat, but it's hard to be a one-eyed man by yourself and get it. This has nothing to do with it, but it was all caps, so I guess I just instinctively did it. Christopher Kowalczyk says, Tim Walz is no longer running for Minnesota governor. So I guess he's not seeking re-election. Yeah, he had a little whoopsie, didn't he? We're not talking about politics today other than that little bit there at the end, but we will tomorrow. That might be what I was in my subconscious thinking when I highlighted Chris's comment there for later comment. Tomorrow will be our first Tuesday coffee chat with John and Nicole at 09:30 Central Standard Time. All three of us will be here together. And I did text Nicole today and said, just so you know, I'm not talking about, I'm not talking about Venezuela. I'm not talking about Tim Walz and the Somali shit. I'm not talking about any current events today because I figure you and John are going to want to talk about that tomorrow. So if you want that kind of stuff, tune in tomorrow, and I got some shit to say. And a lot of you are like, that's what I thought Jack would say. I'm like, I don't think Jack would say that because there's some nuance to some of this stuff. I don't have to agree with it and think we should do it to maybe say that some of those things that people are screaming are illegal and unconstitutional are actually completely legal and constitutional under U.S. law, whether they should be or not. So if you want to know more about that, tune in tomorrow. And then AK Wilderness hit me with a $4.99 super chat. All right. Thank you for that, man. I appreciate it. That's all I got in the live today. So I appreciate all of y'all. If I missed anything, I'm sorry. I'm going to wrap up now. So if I did miss something and you do want me to answer a question or you do want me to comment on something while I'm wrapping up, go ahead and drop it in the comment stream with comment or question in all caps. And right before I'm really, really gone, I'll do it because it has come to that time of day where we talk about the item of the day and the fact that you can support my work and all the stuff that I'm doing just by doing your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. That's tspaz.com, tspaz.com. If you go there, you'll find all my product recommendations, product reviews. It's all stuff I buy, I use. I'd buy it again or I wouldn't suggest it to you. And today's item of the day is the third best-selling item of 2025, and it was the second best-selling item of 2024. And it's just a stupid little thing. But it's the Hamilton Beach 3-in-1 electric egg cooker, and I got this when I wanted to make deviled eggs, and I give away an amazing deviled egg recipe with bacon and using avocado instead of mayo in this write-up if you haven't gotten the recipe yet. It's worth it for that alone. But I hate peeling eggs, especially fresh eggs. When you use these little cookers like this, I don't know what it is, but the eggs just peel so much better. There's my delicious-looking deviled eggs. Those things are so good. But the reason I actually figured I'd bring this around for you is we do have a big contingent of keto, carnivore, paleo, primal-type folks in our audience. And I don't get too evangelical. I try not to anyway with the whole keto carnivore approach, but I do believe that we should be eating real whole foods and animal foods are the best foods for human from a nutrient density standpoint. And I know that it's a new year. It's January. Everybody's got those reservations, those New Year's resolutions and what have you. And, you know, eating right is usually among them. And hey, if you make it easier to eat right, then you'd be more likely to eat right. So if you've ever peeled an egg and it got on, you had a conflict with an egg and you lost and you went into your sympathetic neural state because you were enraged by an egg, like a deranged boomer, and hurled it at a wall or something, this will fix that. I had to cook 100 dozen eggs in this thing in 2 years. I think I've had 2 not peel well. 2. That's a hell of a lot better than my running average was up till then. It works really great. It's like $20. So I thought it'd be good to bring around. And with that, nothing really else has come up other than a comment from Mick, who says, "Thanks, Jack. We love you and are glad you're back." Man, I'm glad to be back too. I don't like being gone for as long as I was. Now, I enjoyed it this time. I'm going to tell you that. But by about Thursday last week, I was starting to get a little stir crazy. Like, I'm ready to get back. I'm ready to get back to it, you know. But what I find is when I take this time off, you know, one of my laws of life is you are a battery, and batteries need maintenance and recharging. And when I go through that kind of, like, your maintenance and recharging is like your day-to-day stuff, like taking a nap and going to bed and eating right and all. But then you have like that where you can do a full discharge and full recharge of the battery and run it through that cycle to kind of refresh it. That's what vacations and time off are like. And when I come back, I feel like I've completely rebooted. I'm really excited. We got a lot of stuff to talk about. Fred is saying Laws of Life should be mandatory reading in high school. If you feel that way, man, pick up a copy for a young person in your life. I know that the first version of it, there was some real editing problems and typesetting problems because of what we called a version inversion, and that's what it was. And we fixed a lot of it, but there's still like some things really not quite perfect. But perfect is the enemy of the good. And perfect is often the enemy of the good enough. I think the book is good enough. It is going to be better. I really want to start working on the next book as soon as this one's done. And it's all but done. It's going to editing next and typesetting after that and jacket design. And I should be able to get it out by March. But I don't really want to go fix the first book. I'm not excited about it. So I'm going to follow one of my laws of life, which is doing what you hate like you love it, a la John Willis. And also putting that as a priority, because if you don't do what you don't want to do, you find a way to never do what you don't want to do. And I want that set of those two books. I'll get a little bit more about the new book here at the end. It's going to be about twice, it's the same number of laws, but about twice the number of words. It's a much richer book, more storytelling, more depth, more analysis, deeper thought, a lot more parasympathetic mindset going into it, and just getting better at something because it's not the first time I ever did it. I mean, yeah, I wrote a book in the past, but it wasn't a real book. And Neil Franklin wrote half of it. The damn thing was damn near a pamphlet. This was the first book I ever wrote. I'm not a professional writer. I'm a professional speaker. I was never a great typist. I was never a great technical writer. But when you do something, you get better at it. And this book, twice as big, produced in a quarter of the time. And a hell of a lot better, so much better that I feel the need to go back and do it. I was always going to do a second edition, but basically it was going to be having it re-edited and fixed. And now what I want to do is I want to back feed the new format into it. So let me give you what that format is. In the first book, if you've read it, going through the chapters, I sprinkle in what I call code rewrites. Like all this stuff we're talking about is about you programming your brain as chief programmer. And if you don't program your brain affirmatively, the negative will be output against you, right? So I have these code rewrites, and they're as much as like an affirmation as they are a way to stay on track with the fact that you have to be conscious about this. So it's better to put something in good than put in nothing at all, because if you put in nothing at all, you will default to the negative. So I sprinkled those code rewrites. So like computer, whenever, do this, right? Well, I realized some of those chapters had 2 or 3. Some had 1, some had none. So in this book, every chapter, the very last thing in the chapter is 3 code rewrites. And they all have 3. Then right before the code rewrites, there's what's called a chapter distill. And this is 10 to 12 bullet points that are like the cliff notes for the chapter, but they're designed to allow the reader to retake the material in like a teacher that gives you a review before they hand out a test. So they're designed to help you relearn what you just learned and commit it more to memory. And then right before that, right at the end of the chapter, there's a bridge into a formula, like today's formula was the FIST formula. But there's 16 formulas in the new book. And those can be consciously run, or they can simply be read and scanned at the end of the chapter to, again, reinforce things like the FIST formula, frame the fight, interrupt the pattern, strike only when necessary and only as hard as necessary, take the win and move. That sums up everything you heard today in four words that form an acronym, FIST. And so that was the one place I really leaned on AI in this, isn't so much writing the formula, but hey, here's the chapter. Give me some. And so AI played a role in this book that it did not play in the first book. There'll be a disclosure on that in the book. It's going to be awesome. And so I really hope you guys, if you haven't gotten the first book yet, please do share it with others. And for those of you who got it, man, there's some typos and shit. I'm sorry, but I ain't perfect. I never said I would be. In fact, I promised I wouldn't. With that, guys, great first day back. Thank you all that were here. Great turnout. Great discussion. I appreciate you guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with John and Nicole early this time. 9:30 Central Standard Time. Tune in. You don't want to miss it. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month.